Good evening, everyone. Welcome to this week's edition of Through the Keyhole. I'm your host, Karen Dolan, coming to you live from Rochester, New York, via the Paranormal Radio Network. We're also on UPRN 105.3 FM in New Orleans. For more information on the show and my guests, visit our website at www.keyholepublishing.com. Thanks so much for joining me this evening. And as every week, I want to hear from you. If you're listening live, join us on the message board to discuss the program and add your questions and comments. You can go to ParanormalRadioNetwork.com to join us in the virtual auditorium where you can participate in the conversation through instant messaging. You can also email me with your questions and comments. My address is kdolan@rochester.rr.com, or you can call into the show anytime toll-free at 1-877-786-0562. And if you missed any of that, it's all on the webpage at keyholepublishing.com. It is time once again for our monthly chat with Rich Dolan and Peter Robbins, two UFO researchers extraordinaire. And I'm so glad that we're all back together because I missed last month. And you guys helped me.
We rocked on pretty hardy, though, Karen. I have to say, Peter and I had a time, didn't we?
And I hope you cleaned up after the party, Rich.
I heard stories about people asking me things.
Who are you going to believe, us or them?
Well, you know, somebody wanted to know about this snowball fight you guys had.
Do you know what this is about, Peter? Karen mentioned this to me after the show, and she said, someone told me that you guys were having like a snowball fight on the air.
Somebody said this to me.
What an arm we must have.
I go to a conference, I keep you guys with my shirt.
Oh, man.
I don't know what that could refer to. Actually, I'm totally...
Allegorical snowball fight of some sort, perhaps? I don't know.
We were pretty good, though. We had a nice animated discussion. I can't remember anything that we discussed at all.
The drugs are wearing off for me, too. But, Karen, I'm real curious to know how things went in Nevada, because we haven't had a chance to talk, and you were the one doing the really exciting stuff. We were home alone just entertaining ourselves.
With snowballs, apparently.
A little bit.
Yeah. And I was off in the desert.
Yes.
I had a fantastic time at the UFO Congress, although I didn't get to see practically any of the speakers.
That's the way it works, being a bureaucrat.
Yeah, that's the fun of working in conference. It was a lot of fun because I'd never worked at that one before.
But you had a huge turnout, I understand.
Yes, we had an enormous turnout. Nikki was saying that we had... I think she said the attendance was up to where it had not been that high since 2005.
You know, that is so good to hear. I think it bodes well in these increasingly uncertain economic times that folks who have a genuine interest in non-standard topics will maintain that interest and, if anything, even deepen it.
Yes, well, I also think it speaks well, if I may jump in here, to Karen's excellent promotion of the
podcast. I guess.
She did a really superb job. Got great feedback, not just from the organizers of the conference, but I think it just showed up in the numbers. You got some major media attention.
And Karen, what's your actual title again for folks that don't know with the conference?
Well, when I was there, when I arrived, they gave me a name tag that said volunteer.
What?
I was working, and I was working the registration desk, and I was stuffing envelopes, and I was having a great time, actually, just getting to know the ropes. I went actually as media relations director, and by the end of the week, they had voted me onto the board of directors.
And Yay!
I am so psyched.
You're mover and shaker now.
Yeah. Well, it was funny because so many people kept saying, "Oh, you did such a great job with the media and publicizing," and we had Time Magazine there, and we had Associated Press there. And I'm thinking, you know, I lucked out so incredibly because the year I started doing promotion was the year these people showed up. I'm not sure that I could trace it back to anything I did, but
sure, it's all
I'm
your
just so glad that everything worked out the way it did.
My only concern
you
is...
Take the credit, why not?
I'm
not sure I did that, but I was just really glad that it worked out.
Well, my only concern is, and I know you can't admit to this, you probably had to take a special pledge, learn the handshake and things, that now... that you're part of the ruling elite of ufology and the door closes, it's It's like being a 33rd degree Mason, right? And you pick and choose what the...
Yeah. I was thinking they're like the Bilderbergers.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you have drinks with the Martians and things. I have a very clear picture of this now, but I want to especially stay on the correct side of you, or, you know, they'll vaporize me and melt me in a bathtub or something.
Well, it was sort of like that scene in The Simpsons when they had the stonecutters up.
Oh, that's my favorite, yeah. Do you sing that song, by the way?
Well, we have a song, yeah.
We've sung it. We've sung the stonecutters scene. We know them all, Peter.
If you sing it, you have to kill everybody in the audience, so just don't sing it now. That's all right.
I just discovered that our daughter has a couple of new friends who came over to visit yesterday.
Yeah.
Their parents don't allow them to watch The Simpsons. So once again...
Oh, my gosh!
Yeah, I was driving them home last night, and I was chatting with Elaine on the way back. She brought it up. I didn't remember how this happened, but she said, yeah, they're not allowed to watch The Simpsons. I thought, this is a show that's been on for 20 years.
I know, we have like 19 seasons on DVD here. We're going, hey, want to watch The Simpsons?
20 years, kid, with a program.
It is an equal opportunity subversive show, too.
Oh,
I mean, they get everybody.
Yeah, they
still the king.
Everybody.
Hey, I want to tell a quick story. It's
yeah.
Our Simpsons story. And then we got to do our UFO paranormal.
Yes, yeah.
We were talking about this. There was a Martian sitting at the table in the Stonecutters episode, all right?
Yes, sure. And again, they sing that part of the song that deals with the Martians, of course.
That's right. Who keeps the Martians under wraps?
That's right.
We do. About almost 20 years ago, it was 1991, I had the fond idea for about 5 minutes that I wanted to get an education degree and maybe teach in area schools, high schools, things like that. So I took a course called Elements of Instruction, which was for teachers. And so we would meet once a week, and every weekend we would meet, and we'd have this long lunch in the middle of this long day of classes. And I was sitting at this table of about 20 professional teachers. I was the only non-teaching professional there. We were just having lunch. And I'll never forget this. I was talking about Hegelian philosophy. Yes, that's the kind of geek that I truly am.
Big mistake.
At the opposite end of the table, I heard this discussion out of my ear, the right part of my ear. Someone saying, oh, that horrible show. I can't believe parents let their kids watch that terrible show. What's it called? The Simpsons. Yeah, this is like 1991, so it was a brand new show. And, of course, me being the big mouth that I've always been, I said, Simpsons? Funniest show on TV. I said, most intelligent show on television today. The next thing that was said at this table was absolutely nothing. Not a word.
That was your career in education.
Table, there was a soup spoon suspended in midair. Like thinking, how could this person say such a horrible thing? And I thought, do I really want to hang out with these people?
Whoa.
You left the program, wasn't
I thought, yeah, I'm out of here, man. I'm just not going to do
that. I hope you learned some kind of...
time we went into the Radio Shack because we just wanted to get an antenna for our TV. We didn't want cable. We just wanted to be able to get a couple of channels. And all I said in
the store,
just want to be able to watch The Simpsons. And it was the same kind of thing. Like, the whole store went silent, and all of that snapped up.
Yeah, it's really true.
Oh, I don't know. You might want to think
of really
locating out of Rochester. This is a little unnerving to me.
Yeah. We got a scary country, guys. Let's just face it.
Yeah, it's true.
So, here we are, doing our thing.
Well, let me begin by saying that I have just read part of an unpublished book, and I have been quite knocked out by it, and I'm very much looking forward to the book coming out. I believe it's going to be titled UFOs and the National Security State, Part 2. I read it like a novel, and I have to say here, and this is absolutely unsolicited, ladies and gentlemen, I do not get paid for my work on this program.
Neither do I.
yes, but you're married to him. I'm not. And it is, you know, we've all, those of us in the field that follow your work and so value your first book, this is another kind of book. It's another kind of UFO book. And you've done something that I am simply not familiar with in previous books. It is, of course, strictly chronological, and we're moving from 73 to 91, if I recall correctly.
That's right, yes.
Yeah. And what you do, besides discuss important cases with good, clear observations is you really go out of your way to acknowledge sources, and in some cases they're fairly arcane books. Renato Vesco's Intercept But Don't Shoot.
Yes, you got that.
A lot of very fine works that are not major things in ufology in America. You also, and you promised this, so to say, in your introduction, which I read, 2 months ago or something now, that you would be layering in information about the way power works. And you've done it in a way that's very natural and yet very exciting. In context, when we're moving along and we get to Gerald Ford's presidency,
yes,
we learn, or we're reminded, that he was a member of Council on Foreign Relations, attended a number of Bilderberger Group meetings, was a 33rd degree Mason,
exactly,
discussing even aspects of the assassination attempts against him, and then using those as an opportunity to segue briefly into some information about these power groups. And I sense what's going to happen as I continue to read on is that it will all come together in a way where the multiple layering will give us a different view of ufology, like a diamond with extra facets. And I was also very pleased to see that when you discuss Jackie Gleason's legendary incident with Richard Nixon,
right,
that you bring in the account of my friend and co-author Larry Warren, who heard it right from Gleason's mouth. And also you reference one of my real mentors in this work, a guy who's hardly even a footnote in ufology but should be acknowledged, and that's a former Hungarian staff officer from World War II, Komen von Kavetsky, who in fact was in charge of all photo reconnaissance and visual education and film making for the Hungarian army during World War II. It's a very extraordinary piece of research, and the reading of it is kind of effortless. I mean, I have an idea of what goes into composing and weaving together segments like this. So hats off to you. This is really, really exciting.
Peter, you have no idea how gratified I am to hear this. I have very few readers of what you've just read. I only sent you the first chapter.
Yes, exactly. And again, you kind of live in fear on a certain level, and I say this to our audience as a published author in this field who has a certain amount of credibility, that your colleagues who go on to write books of their own inevitably are going to be in touch with you at some point or another saying, would you mind taking a look at this part of my manuscript? Or every once in a while, I've had the job of being hired to write reviews for books by people who are really friends of mine. And I share partly because I realize my first commitment is to the truth. And if I don't like their writing, it can really hurt a friendship that may be important to me. And it's, on one level, it's wonderful to have another great piece of literature to add to the important work of ufology. On a more personal level, it's such a relief to know it's a great book. Not that I didn't think it was going to be, but it's a different, you can see also how you've grown as a researcher and a writer from part one, which is a terrific book, and if it stood alone, you know, it would have established your reputation as a single volume. But knowing that it is now going to be part of a trilogy, and my goodness, if you're doing this on the first chapter in volume two, where are you going to be at the middle of volume three? I shudder to think.
Well, wow, Peter, I have to tell you, I'm just so happy to hear this type of feedback.
Well, I think you're going to be hearing a lot of it once.
Well, I hope so. I mean, the story that I've been putting together, it's taken me many, many years. But and I felt horrible. Every year would go by, and the book was still not done.
No, that one.
But I don't have any regrets any longer because the amount of time that it took, I think, was necessary.
Yeah, but it does become like an independent relationship, much like one with your parents, your kids, your wife. And, you know, you sit down, and it's back to, oh, hello, how are you today? and what kind of problems are you going to give me, or are we going to have a, you know, a amicable experience on this session?
What I tried to do with this book and certainly with the subsequent volume 3, which is all research, actually.
Very exciting.
But it's pulling together many, many different threads that, I mean, it's been an exploration for me to see how well they actually weave together, but I think they've come together very well.
Well, I think that this kind of writing, and a lot of folks think of nonfiction writers as kind of dry bones. It's very much like the work of any visual artist, filmmaker, or painter. You have a blank canvas there, and you are sitting down. You do not know.
Right. I'm hearing an advertisement in the background.
Yeah, me too. Don't quite know
where that's coming from.
I do not.
Okay, thank you very much.
I have something.
All right.
Well, I got somebody, I mean, on the chat room, they're telling me about Black Ops while this is coming on. Like, oh,
Well,
I don't know who that is.
Peter, I'm so gratified. If I can, now, the whole philosophy that I had going into this book, it's really trying to hit three major threads, three major trends going into this study. So the first would be really well-documented UFO encounters that happened. And then this book, being the second part of a trilogy, covers basically the 1970s and 80s up to the end of the Cold War, 1991.
Yeah.
So, for example, it's something of an encyclopedia in the sense that if you wanted to think, oh, gee, what about that 1978 case? I wonder if Dolan has it in his book. And you could look it up.
Yep,
and
it's right there in chronological order.
Right, you'd find it easily. Hopefully it would be a nice, complete, concise description of what you're looking for. A second thread is more of what I call the geopolitical side of things.
Yes.
So not just understanding the military and intelligence community's response to UFOs, that's a big part of it, but more than that, as you were suggesting, trying to understand the structure of power behind this whole thing. In other words, who's running the show? In the last 5 years in particular, we've heard a lot about disclosure in the UFO field. How are we going to get disclosure of the UFO reality? Will the president disclose the truth, and so on and so on? It really got me thinking, well, is the president a guy who's in the position of doing this? And maybe yes, but maybe no. And so when we ask ourselves, forgetting UFOs, just looking at the structure of power in general, who is in charge in the world? Well, there's a lot of reasons to believe it's not really the president of the United States. When you look at who are the kingmakers, who's making the president, that's why I got into some discussion of groups like the Bilderbergers and CFR and so on.
And this is one of the things, just to interject for a moment, that makes this book stand out against other chronological or anthology-based books like, going way back, Margaret Sachs' UFO Encyclopedia from 1980, or either edition of Jerome Clark's very fine UFO Encyclopedia, or Tim Good's Above Top Secret or Beyond Top Secret. They're fine for what they are, but you, again, we're seeing it in three dimensions rather than strictly ufological.
Thanks. That's really what I tried to do. And the other thread that I tried to do, I don't think has been done in any UFO book that I've ever seen, which is an analysis of ufology itself. In other words,
yes,
really trying to understand how we students of this phenomenon have evolved in our own way of looking at UFOs. Back in the early 70s, people were looking at UFOs in a certain way, and by the 1990s, they were not necessarily looking at it the same way. It's an amazing story how you get from the one point to the next. There's a real evolution, a lot of revolutions going on, dramatic changes, and I really felt it was important to capture all of that. So in a sense, it's humanity's interaction with this phenomenon and the changing of our own thought processes.
And I think that's going to be the most valuable things, and I'm willing to, I'm not a very good prognosticator. I don't go in for predictions, and I have a feeling, although it may upset a lot of listeners, that we may get through 2012 without much happening, and that will be very upsetting for everybody waiting for the end of the world. But I think this book is going to have an influence on the next generation of writers on this subject. You have made something all right that has not been tried until now. And again, it's a much more real-world way to look at this, and it peels back several more layers of the onion for us to not just look at this extremely mysterious phenomena, but to see it in terms of the way we human beings scuttering around are trying to address it or trying to hide it. And again, the way that we people in the field are perceiving it, the politics in a way inherent in UFO studies, and I say that as somebody whose interest began fairly early on in your narrative. Mine clicked on almost overnight in 1976, and when I came into the field, it was still very much an area of research where we, the research community, were involved in noting the model automobile and the license plate and not giving much thought to the drivers or which license they carried. What was going on inside? Reading through it, it reminded me of hearing David Jacobs say something so simple yet so profound, which he said on a number of occasions, and he certainly is one of our great contributors, which is somewhere out there is a factory that manufactures metal tables for specifically designed for human beings to lie on. These tables are fabricated and they are installed in certain rooms that are designed for people to be moved through with high efficiency, and then there are instruments which come down and they are designed by designers somewhere, and those designs are, put into a tool. You go, oh my God.
Exactly.
Of course,
it
it's true,
time.
But don't usually think about that aspect of things.
Very true. It took a lot of time for researchers to move down that path. Back in the 1950s, when this is all new, people dealing with this phenomenon, it's easy for us to forget this, but the idea of flying saucers was pretty far out enough. And so to then claim that you had some sort of interaction with the actual beings in there, I mean, that just wasn't credible to most researchers. And back in the 50s and 60s, we know for a fact that the major organizations were getting reports of alleged sightings and contact with alien beings, but these groups would never investigate, almost ever, because the stories were just too crazy. And so it took like an entire generation or even more than that. It really until the 1970s when there were just more and more abduction cases started coming out. And that's really, I think, what did it in large measure, that researchers started to have to stop and say, wait a minute, there's more going on here than just a bunch of metallic craft surveying the Earth to scope us out to see if they want to invade. There's a lot of these things going around. It's been happening for 25 or 30 years or whatever, and we've got claims of people dealing with these beings. What exactly is going on? And the other thing I believe that really sparked a reevaluation of this whole concept, in a sense, was the slap down by the so-called Condon Committee in the late 60s.
Oh.
In other words, because in the 1960s, UFOs were becoming a big, big thing in this country, and Congress was talking about it. All the Air Force wanted to do was just unload Project Blue Book, which was their official...
Well, let's face it, they were assigned the job because they're the Air Force.
Right.
They clicked into existence in September 47, just bad luck in a way.
So what happened was the Air Force contracted with the University of Colorado, and many of us know this is just kind of a rigged game. And in 1969, the word came down from Colorado, nothing to it, Air Force should drop Project Blue Book, and the Air Force did. And so UFO research was left kind of in a shambles. It was a major, it's like getting a knockout in this heavyweight bout, and you're down, and so now what do you do?
Just so.
In the aftermath of that, one of the major UFO organization, NICAP, basically went right down the drain, and suddenly there wasn't a whole lot going on. And so UFO researchers, it took them a few years, but really what you see is a kind of regrouping and a reinvention of ufology. It's what they started calling it, ufology, and in particular the phrase scientific ufology. And
yes.
And I think what happened there was that it prompted many thinkers and researchers to take a fresh look, step back a little bit, and say, let's just back away from hammering on the conspiracy claims, and let's back away from assuming that we're talking about extraterrestrial vehicles. Let's look at some other possibilities here. And some of those possibilities, some of those directions may not have been all that fruitful somewhere. But what it really did is I think it provoked and promoted a new level of creativity. And I think that really continued. And then, of course, what happened is that by the late 1980s, we start getting the Internet. And that just exploded the whole field. Because right up until the mid-late 80s, all of the changes and all of the stuff going on in ufology, it was a very active field, but it was all basically a club.
Yes.
Had a bunch of guys, a couple of gals. They all knew each other. They all read each other's work. They all published in the same very few journals.
Yeah.
There was more than many. The MUFON Journal, there up until the mid-80s, there was the APRO Bulletin, and a couple of others. Not a lot. There were very limited circulation.
Flying Saucer Review in the UK?
Right, right. But, I mean, for the most part, it was difficult for most people to get these. Circulation was just not that much. Suddenly, in 1987, you start getting something called Paranet, which was really the earliest version of the Internet. People don't realize that UFOs were one of the first, other than like computer geek stuff, like programming, UFOs was one of the first bulletin board systems that was put out on the Internet.
I'm proud to say it was right up there with porn, the other great pioneer.
Ahead of porn. It was ahead because back in the 1980s, there was no graphic internet.
They didn't have decent graphics browsers, right?
No, they may have had sexy stories, but that's...
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Really, the UFO topic truly led the way. And in 1987, the first UFO bulletin board system got put up by a fellow named Jim Spicer.
Yeah.
And that unbelievably just exploded the field because suddenly all you needed now is a computer and a modem.
Isn't it amazing?
And,
it's true.
Even in 87, a lot of people had it and they started just publishing their stuff and you got all these outsiders suddenly the old club finds itself besieged by a stream then a flood then an ocean of new voices.
Yeah.
And so, and a lot of those new voices were very brilliant. Some of them were kind of loopy, right? That's what you expect. But for better and for worse, it really broke the unity of ufology. And we really see it to this day, frankly. At the same time that the Internet happened, we start getting the people hanging outside of Area 51.
Mm-hmm.
All right, really all at the same time. So we get into some serious conspiracy ideas. Some of them, I think, very reasonable. Others, maybe not so. But that's really the story. It's an incredible intellectual journey, and it really reflects the developments of our own society.
Well, I think another very exciting thing about the book is it may well open a whole other avenue of interest among people who have never seriously considered looking into the subject beyond the wink and the nudge novelty or...
always my goal.
Potential great anxiety. But this is now multi-layered. It is world history, but you focus in on, you know, the American aspect to a greater degree, being, you know, trained in American history primarily.
Right.
But it is living, breathing history. And
as the book goes on, you'll see a much greater emphasis on a global phenomenon, actually.
Well, all the better then, because
yeah.
This is the kind of thing that can bring it to life for a lot of people. You know, I love studying history. I've never trained in it. It was always a favorite subject of me next to the arts in high school. I'm a good amateur historian. I still enjoy taking friends or working professionally as a historic tour guide of New York City. Wherever I am, I will try to learn what I can about local history. But there are certain quote-unquote history books that have the power of great fiction because they're reality and well written. Michael Beschloss is a historian who's writing, you know, he's sort of a pop historian on a certain level. He's not the most extraordinary scholar in our pantheon, but his book Mayday, about the U-2 crash, it being shot down by the Russians, is absolutely breathless. It's as good as a John le Carré piece of fiction. And there is an aspect of what I'm seeing in this chapter that makes me feel this is going to be a heck of a read. It's not some dry scholarly tome. It's also a book, I think, that those of us that value contributions to the work will take a particular enjoyment in loaning out to our most skeptical or sarcastic or circumspect friends and say,
glad to hear it.
Read this. Let's talk in a few weeks.
I try to. I haven't finished counting the number of military UFO encounters that are in this book. Like I did with my first volume, there were, I think, about approximately 300 military encounters in volume one of my work. This one covers a slightly less of a period of time. It's about just under 20 years. But I believe I've got about 200 military encounters that I've recounted in this book. So it's very similar in density to the first book. What I find is that when you look over the sheer quantity of good reports, I mean, there's a very small minority of reports I've included that I would say I included because I think that they have the ring of truth and they're not necessarily of the strongest backing, but that's a very tiny minority. 95%, I think, are very, very solidly done. And when you look at those, it's this sledgehammer effect that it has on me when I look over just one case after another, after another, after another. I mean, there's a case of a Portuguese pilot in the Portuguese Air Force, and this object comes near him. It's just like one of the old Foo Fighter reports from World War II. This object comes near him, bright object, and causes his aircraft's controls to go offline. And he starts diving, like he's going to crash into the ground. He regained control of his aircraft at treetop level. There were ground witnesses astonished at this whole thing. When he got to his base, he actually couldn't speak for a couple of hours. He was totally traumatized.
Yes.
And that's just one case.
You've brought up
many of these.
Very important. As we kind of become knowledgeable as we grow more mature in our lives, it can be looking at a great spatial horizon and taking in 1,000 different facts, or in a more Zen sense, it can be staring at a spot on the wall and finding enlightenment ultimately through another avenue. And working on Left at East Gate for 9 years, which was a matter of documenting what's far and away the best known and best documented UFO incident in the history of Great Britain, I had similar little epiphanies where you're 4, 7, 8 years into your project and you've laid in another fact in this pantheon of information, and you find yourself as the chronicler going, good Lord, this is really happening, and look at the sweep of it.
Yeah.
And for me, I'm talking about, one event composed of a series of incidents. You're talking about hundreds of incidents all over the world, which in themselves are a microcosm for the bigger picture here.
Yeah, the one thing about that that actually scares me to this day is when I look at this book, there are several real minefields that I have been trying to negotiate my way through in doing this book. And the book is... all of it is, let's say 99% of it is written. There's the very final part of Chapter 9, which is the final chapter I'm going to finish, and then just write the conclusion. Right now what I'm doing is going through the earlier chapters and cleaning them up.
Oh, yeah.
But there is one minefield after another in these 20 years that I'm covering, and it's, I'm just sure that there's going to be a few that I may not have gotten to my satisfaction. I'm dealing with one right now. The final bit of research for this book, I've actually gone backtracking to the infamous case of Paul Benowitz.
Oh, gosh.
Who was a scientist, defense contractor, private contractor for the DOD back in the 1970s and 80s. And Paul Benowitz lived right directly across from Kirtland Air Force Base in the Manzano weapons storage area there. And with very high-tech equipment, began to record what he was convinced were UFOs, or very anomalous activity, and also, even more interesting, he was recording with acoustic equipment signals that he became convinced were alien communications of some sort. Now, the Benowitz case has gotten some treatment from a variety of researchers back in the 80s. Jerome Clark, I know, wrote about it. And then most significantly, a few years ago, Gregory Bishop wrote Project Beta, which is all about this.
Mm.
Well, now I like Greg very much, and but he also knows that I've disagreed with him in his interpretation
yep.
of the Benowitz case. And just to put it bluntly, the Bishop's argument is that Paul Benowitz was indeed tracking very, very unusual, anomalous things over Kirtland and Manzano. These were not probably UFOs, although Greg, to his credit, leaves open that possibility that they
yep.
may have been man-made UFOs.
Sure.
But I think that's... Actually, I think I agree with this. But his primary argument is that the NSA and Air Force Intelligence said, we've got to disable this guy right now.
Mm.
Because he's looking at high-tech equipment that we have that actually have nothing to do with UFOs, but he's going to mess us up anyway if he keeps snooping around. So we're going to divert him to its other interest, which is Dulce, New Mexico, and then convince him that there's an alien base up there.
Mm.
Now, it sounds like a great idea and a great thesis, but in fact, I'm going to be pointing out in my book why I actually disagree with that interpretation.
Good.
And it is my argument that Paul Benowitz was seeing and encountering UFOs. I just spoke today, in fact, with my very good friend Ron Regere, who was a close friend of Benowitz back in the 80s.
I didn't realize that.
Yes, indeed. Ron did a lot of work for in making what was called the Defense Support Program, basically spy satellites, back in the 1980s. And was very highly technically trained himself, but knew Paul Benowitz and had a lot of Paul's notes, which I have access to.
Wow.
So I've been going through these for this book, and Ron was just telling me today that he had back in the 80s, when he was talking with Paul all the time about these UFOs, he said on one occasion he went in unannounced to Kirtland Air Force Base and spoke to the Colonel Edwards, who was one of the top dogs there, really involved in the UFO stuff, knew Paul Benowitz very well, they were friends. And Ron said, hey, you know, I just wanted to ask you, Paul tells me that you guys, the two of you, took three helicopter trips recently and you had strange stuff happen. This was completely off guard for the colonel. He had no anticipation that Ron was going to be meeting with him.
Yeah.
And he said, yes, in fact, that we did. He said exactly what Paul had told Ron, which is that on one particular helicopter trip, we're going out looking for some of the strange things that Paul was seeing, because Paul Benowitz was a private pilot and would see things over places. He said, we're on a helicopter, and it's got airborne radar, and we tracked this one object at a certain far distance. 6 seconds later, when the radar had completed its sweep, it was feet away from the helicopter. It was a silver sphere that came right up to our helicopter. And we looked at each other, and we said, well, that's not anything that we make. And
wow.
So that's part of the story, and it gets kind of left out when people talk about Paul Benowitz, because the idea is that somehow he did lose his emotional stability after a while. He got very, very tightly wound, was hospitalized in the late 1980s for a short while. And so and plus he was the target to some extent of disinformation by William Moore. And, yes, there were disinformation efforts being directed at him to some degree by Air Force Intelligence. But the real issue is, why were they going after him? Was it to dissuade him from looking into somewhat mundane types of technologies like the Starfire optical range that some people have talked about, which is a great system to look, you know, into the atmosphere at objects? Or was it to mess him up regarding UFOs, or maybe even not that much disinformation against him.
Indeed.
I'm not seeing a huge amount of evidence for a concerted disinformation campaign against Benowitz. I'm just not seeing it. I'm seeing a little bit. I'm not seeing a lot. I think he was encountering actual UFO activities, and one of the things I have in his notes is some very, creepy stuff that he believed that he translated. Alien messages.
Oh boy!
And I'll have a little bit of it actually in the book. He was translating these or getting them as early as 1980. This is well before the Air Force or NSA was known to be doing anything against him at all. So he was getting some kind of signals. At least he believed he was getting signals that talked about Mount Archuleta Peak near Dulce and a base underneath there and how to kill the aliens down there and heavy-duty, creepy stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, just how he came to get these messages is a question that I was discussing with my friend Ron. And we don't really know. It's not known how Paul Benowitz came to these conclusions. The best guess that we have is, oh golly, here someone's calling my other line. That's no good. We'll turn that off.
Somebody needs a resume right now.
Well, they ain't gonna get it. I lost my whole train of thought. The whole thing was that, well, you get the idea. So I think Paul was onto something very significant, and that's going to be the point that I'm going to make in this book, and we'll see how that goes. Well, that's just one minefield, and there's a whole million others. There's the Majestic, the issue of MJ-12.
Oh, boy, yeah, that's
never goes away.
And many shows just on that one topic, of course. But I wanted to get as much as we could into this program just on how excited I am that we do have this book coming at us in a few months, and it is one that folks should be ordering, looking out for, recommending to their friends, and reading. And then, you know, writing the website, and if you have any specific questions, by all means, cornering Rich at conferences and asking them in great detail.
That's right. The information on this will be on the website, keyholepublishing.com.
Right.
The book itself will be completely finished probably within 2 weeks. And after that, it's just a matter of finding out the best way to get it printed and out.
Who is going to be publishing it? Are you going to do a self-publishing
then? I think we're going to self-publish at this point.
I think legally we have to still check over a few things. But I know that at this point,
relative to HR,
that we have to work around, but yeah, we're certainly considering self-publishing at this point.
Well, I thought that was very smart, and of course, as many readers know, your original edition was then picked up by HR. That
is
a slightly different edition, and I'll tell you what: if I had it all to do over again, Larry agrees with me. We would have self-published Left at East Gate. Again, with the hope of having a professional publisher picking it up after the first edition. I think you're smart to do that, and that way you control a great deal more, and word of mouth is very powerful. And in this day of internet networking, you can get a tremendous amount of information out there into the great world maw, and do as much as a lot of publishers do for their authors anyway.
We know how to do the publishing process. We can create a really nice looking book as a result, and I think that we'll have control over the product, which is very important.
I really like the artwork you've found for the cover.
Ooh.
Website. I think it's beautiful.
Yes. Yeah, I got a really excellent artist named Mike Braband, Mark Braband, who offered to do some artwork for the book's cover. And the original one he did was this kind of eerie-looking greenish scene with some trees in the background.
It
doesn't look UFO-like at all. But I said, well, could you put a couple of lights in the sky? So he did that, and I think that's going to be just what we need.
Bravo!
Nice-looking book. Yeah, a couple of weeks.
That's new and exciting.
And then the book will be in print. And so, yeah, I would just encourage anyone who's interested to check out the website. It'll be very easy to find out how to get the book. Initially, it will be available immediately off of our website. We'll get it going on Amazon and maybe other online opportunities as well.
Absolutely.
And then we'll work out distributors to get it into the bookstores.
Yeah. And, of course, we'll have it at conferences.
Oh, yes.
It'll be available.
Yeah.
I think... Yeah, I'm feeling good about the book. It's been a long time coming, and finally, it's really done. It's like a little baby that's being born.
I might be able to talk to my husband without putting him on my radio show with me.
I think you've got a little bit of pull there if you wiggle the right knobs and pull strings and, you know, send out feelers, all that stuff. You bet. What's your next? Are you speaking at the X conference next month?
I am, yes.
Okay, good. The book, or are you zoning in on some aspect of another area of study?
I'm going to do my book. I'll just be talking about that, I think, for most of this year now. I go back and forth. The two main things that I expect to be discussing, because I'm always asked to talk about disclosure to some extent or exopolitics. Or something.
Oh, yeah.
I do find that topic interesting, and I'm finding that as I think about this, I'm finding more things that I want to say about it. So that's absolutely always on my agenda. But I think this year is the year that I'm just going to be discussing this new book that's out. I think it's, without trying to sound overly high and mighty, I think it's an important book, and I think it's a book that has not ever really been done, as you were saying. And
yep.
I want to be able to make sure that the word gets out. I want people to know their history. The 1970s and 80s, right up to the end of the Cold War, really did turn out to be a kind of turning point in the modern world. And I think understanding that period of history is critically important for understanding the issues of ufology today.
Well, I think even more than that, I think this is the kind of book that, especially for a younger generation of up-and-coming UFO investigators, writers, researchers, this is the kind of book that has the potential not just to educate, but to excite people about wanting to know more about history. It's like learning how to use a power tool. You're more self-reliant, even if you're not, you know, building houses. This is the kind of book that, yes, it has a specialty, which is UFOs, but it is also a bridge to the excitement of knowing more about history and how things have gotten to where they are right now. This being,
I often feel like you know, like in The Matrix, at the end of The Matrix with Neo, who's penetrated past The Matrix, and now he sees this illusion for everything that it is, and then he goes back into The Matrix to try to open the minds of those people who are ready to be open. And honestly, that is exactly what I try to do in this book. I'm not saying that I've succeeded, but my goal at all times is to open one's perception on really what is the nature of our world, what is the structure of our power system in this world.
Yeah.
How does it all fit together? I've developed a very different perspective on that over the last decade than I had as a younger person. And there's no way I could avoid getting that into the book. It's all in there, for better or for worse.
Yeah.
I'm sure there are going to be some old-timers, the old school, who say, you know, you've editorialized too much, you've thrown too much of your opinion in there. And really all that I would say is, no, what I've tried to do is put in an analysis. It's not just, as you say, a straight recitation of facts. There's analysis. There's an attempt to really understand what, you know, what is going on here, really to try to think through this very, very difficult, challenging topic.
It is. And when push comes to shove and everything comes full circle and the book is out, and you do not need to rationalize it or defend it, it's there. If you're interested, you can read it. That, in a sense, makes you an educator. And for those people that were sitting in the room with you in the early 90s when you invoked that terrible word, Simpsons, this man is an educator. And we don't even know who you are anymore, and then Richard Dolan and the Simpsons thrive and continue on.
And any listeners who don't know what we're talking about, you're going to have to download the show later and catch the beginning, because that was really the beginning of the show.
You know, there's one other thing about this that's really quite relevant. Earlier today in my office, you know, for those of you who don't know, I mean, I have a day job, believe it or not. It's not just doing UFO things, although writing this book has become my day job. But to make some money now and then, I write professional resumes for people, and I've been doing this for many years. I have a nice office here at the house, and people come in and they set an appointment, sit down, and I make them look marvelous. So now the problem with that is, however, when they come into my office, you see walls of books, and when you
and
sit down,
UFO in the title.
Well, when you look to your right, the whole wall is nothing but UFO this and conspiracy that. That's my
maybe I should find somebody else to write my resume. Is my thought.
So
and then
so
there's rolls of aluminum foil for the hat.
Well, you know.
Here, put this on.
You make them wear a metal cap.
Is that I get a really interesting insight into the general public's attitude about all of this, because these are people from entry level right up through senior exec and everything in between. It's the whole
I'm sure there's a certain amount of nervous patter of, oh, you're interested in UFOs, I see.
Yes, exactly. So I had in my office earlier today was a woman who was very pleasant. She's a finance manager, you know, just kind of with the Excel spreadsheets and doing her thing. And just as we were wrapping up, you know, everything was strictly business, she looks over to the right and she says, oh, wow, UFOs. And I said, well, yeah, and I wrote that book over there. And she said, oh, my God, wow. So at first, right, she's very into it. She's like, oh, that's very interesting, and you really believe in that? And I say, well, yeah, I guess what I would say that I do. But here's the thing. I didn't even scratch the surface. I mean, not even scratching the surface with this poor lady who was about 40. She's not old,
yeah.
You know, right? Mm-hmm. And she never left. Lost her smile, but like within 2-3 minutes, she said, I think I'm getting freaked out by this. She really said that. She said, I think I'm getting freaked out by this.
Yes. Wow.
And I said, well, we should just stop. That's fine.
Well, you know, that's pretty cool that she was able to see that and to articulate that, because a lot of people can't.
Well, that I
know. No, she was a very intelligent person, but like a lot of people who are in the Matrix.
Yes.
All right, their intelligence is very focused toward a particular thing, and they kind of forget to look beyond that.
Yep.
And so when something comes along by a person who seems to know what he's talking about, that really rocks their worldview, really challenges everything they thought they believed was true, that's a very stressful thing. And that is the difficulty that we in this field have all the time, of course. Because the implications of what we're talking about, non-human beings, whether they're from another planet, whether they're from another dimension, whether they're from the future, all right?
It's almost a moot point. They're not here.
Right. They're doing things here. They are interacting. They're not out there. They're down here.
Yes.
And so when you start recognizing, then you start thinking, wow, everything I thought I knew, well, what's up with that? All the history that I thought I studied. And you get a couple of different reactions. You get the kind of the confident, smug, educated types, and I've dealt with a lot of those, who say, well, that can't be, that's impossible.
I'd know
that's
about
absurd.
It.
That's absurd. Right, I would have known, because I'm smarter than you, and therefore, well, you're just crazy. And then you get the other people who go a little farther than that, but like this person today in my office, who was genuinely disturbed, because it was a real shock. And then, of course, there are people who just get excited. But what you find is that it's a rare person who at least initially can really take this idea to the goal line. They take it a little bit, and they're like, oh, yeah, well, I like UFOs. I'm fascinated by it. Or it's like this intellectual puzzle for them.
Yeah.
But when it starts to become real, like to them personally or to a family member, then it's a real hard thing to deal with. And
well, when they meet a person who is otherwise sane, functioning, grown up, a parent, a professional, not unlike yourself, who actually obviously takes this seriously, just by the fact that they are there, it can be threatening to you. And I think therein lies a great deal of the history of the human dynamics here. When we were talking a bit about how organized ufology was dealing with this subject in the 60s, the 70s, before things started to change, it was made all the sense in the world for the leaders in organizations like NICAP, like MUFON, to want to be treated with respect, to want to be yet another professional peer group. And even though they're dealing with this outsider topic, to not stray so far publicly that they would make themselves into a target. And to a degree, we
right.
still see that.
Well, and this really had affected, I think, the belief systems of many of these members. In other words, they become almost hyper-conservative in a way.
Yes.
Kind of strange. But you find a lot of UFO researchers, especially in the earlier years, it's really not quite as much today, but back in the 50s and 60s and 70s and into the 80s, there was a typical UFO researcher of that period of time. There were a couple of studies done on this. Their political beliefs tended to be conservative, not liberal.
Yeah.
Okay? Which really, I think, is almost opposite what one would expect today. I mean, there are researchers of all kinds of political beliefs
sure.
today, too. But I would hazard to guess that most would be considered liberal, not conservative. Not so in the earlier years. They tended to be in their 40s or above, a little bit above average income, well-educated, kind of stodgy, you know? But the whole point was they were in this very out-there type of field, and as a result, they went bent over backwards, you might say, to keep a very kind of rational approach to what they did. So they would self-censor. They would censor out all the crazy stories of abductions and... And then with the cattle mutilations, this is another part of the book that I've dealt with.
Yeah.
There was a great deal of resistance to the idea that cattle mutilations had anything at all to do with UFOs.
I remember when it broke in. The first book was a book called Mystery Stalks the Prairie.
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
I ordered a copy mail order, $7.95. Boy, do I wish I bought a case of those. Read it. I was completely unnerved. And my first thought was, how is this going to reflect on ufology? My second thought, of course, was my natural intellectual curiosity looked into it and at a certain point began to normalize, if that's the word for it, that indeed aspects of this area of study, disturbing as it was, did definitely intersect with the UFO phenomena.
Yeah, I think absolutely that's right.
Oof.
But there's always that resistance, and it's a fear that those of us in this field, we all want respectability, we all want to be loved, we all want the pat on the back.
Yeah.
And so we want to get the established powers to support us, and so we're afraid, in a sense, to go out there. But the fact is, you know, the reality is far more radical than our own ideas.
Yeah.
That's the problem that we keep running into. People think that they're out on the cutting edge, and then what they find is that the phenomenon is far beyond even that, and we're constantly trying to catch up
Please.
To this paradigm-shattering, reality-shattering thing, and we still haven't gotten there.
No,
because I really have a feeling that the true, ultimate truth on this is still beyond what any of us in the field are really discussing even now.
Yeah, I think once again we're like people walking around blindfolded, feeling different parts of the elephant, and deducing what we can from the part of the elephant that we have in hand. And that great, I'm trying to remember whether it's Spinoza or Schopenhauer, but I'm bastardizing the quote a bit, but the universe is not only stranger than we imagine, it's stranger than we can imagine. And it keeps coming back to that. We are all just human beings trying to make sense of something that is so beyond any individual. Together, I think that we're progressing as well as we can, but there is so much specious, goofy, sensationalized, distorted confabulation and nonsense mixed in with the truly important findings and scholarship. We do our best to sort it out as we go. It's important that we all are our own best skeptics and vet things as we move forward. Nowhere more important than in the case of people like us who do this work professionally. If we fall prey to accepting something simply because we know that it's real from previous research on independent, unconnected matters, and this one turns out to be completely hokey, we are going to be left with egg on our face. So, you know, you proceed, I think the best model is investigating these things in the same manner that law enforcement personnel are generally taught to investigate criminal behavior.
Right.
You're plotting, you're putting one foot in front of the other and doing your best to assemble the pieces so you can triangulate and establish evidence out of different bits of information.
Exactly.
That's a really good example, Peter, because I was just thinking that, you know, even in law enforcement, there are things that people do. There are, you know, perhaps, just as an example, say, ritual abuse crimes.
Oh my God.
There are things that are just so completely out there that the general public would think, that's outrageous. No person would do that. I can't believe that.
Of course. The things that...
But anybody in law enforcement who has studied this would look at a new case and would be able to say, yeah, I've seen this element before.
That's
I've seen
right.
this before. I've
well,
seen this.
You couldn't have said it better, Karen, and I feel particularly blessed because as I was coming up through the ranks, I had three genuine mentors, each one in turn who took me under their wing and who taught me what they do and how they do it. The first was Coleman von Kavetsky, this military scientist who was a Hungarian Army staff officer. The second was Pete Mazzola, who was a New York City police detective and a crack UFO investigator. And the third was Bud Hopkins, whose investigative techniques were so strictly scientific in so many ways that I remember about a week before my very first research trip to Suffolk, England with Larry Warren. I thought it was going to be my only trip there, little did I know, to begin to investigate the Rendlesham Forest incident. I had set up lectures for Larry and I with an independent educational institution in Princeton, New Jersey. And our audience was overwhelmingly PhDs, psychiatrists, psychologists, research scientists. And Bud spoke for them as well as Larry and I. And a number of these therapists, to a degree, who I knew socially, took me aside after and said, where did Hopkins do his scientific studies? I said, he has not studied science. He's a painter. I said, oh, yes, he is. There's no way he could have developed such a strict, classical, scientific methodology with instruction, you know, in an accredited...
Well, he was trained. He was trained by professional hypnotherapists.
Well, that's true, but this went beyond the work that he had learned from Aphrodite Clamar and the other hypnotic therapists. It was more if you are a grounded person, if you have a good sense of common sense.
Well, he happens to be brilliant, which doesn't hurt.
No. These human skills cannot be underscored enough. The most important, because none of us go to school for this stuff. Well, there are rare exceptions. If you go to Temple University and study with Dave Jacobs or take a course with that small handful of respected academics peppered around the country at different institutions of learning who may quietly be instructing people in this formally in a syllabus or, you know, in seminars separate from this university. But most of us educate ourselves and do the best we can. But good common sense is certainly a major asset.
Right.
Yeah.
Most definitely.
Yeah.
Keeping your feet on the ground.
Amen. And your eyes on the sky and right behind you, too.
On that topic, have either of you come across very much I'm trying to think how to put this. We were talking, well, Rich, you mentioned stodgy ufologist, which I thought was hysterical.
It's a great term. It immediately conjures.
I really love
that.
That's
us.
Harumph, harumph.
No. How can you be a ufologist and be stodgy?
Well, you can.
But, you know, we're talking about seeing things that even ufologists think are just too far out there.
Yep.
We're not going to consider it.
And even if they are real, let's not talk about this. And
yeah.
It's just going to make us all look silly.
I've been finding lately evidence of certain people in the ufology field who hear other people's research or they hear other people discussing questions, and they seem to have this attitude that I can't believe in that, therefore that can't be true, therefore you're not a legitimate researcher.
Well, sadly, I observe the same thing over the years. Sometimes it may have to do with a little bit of jealousy or insecurity or feeling out of your own depth. Occasionally, it's because these people do come off half-cocked or their quote-unquote research may be, as we've all had the experience, especially at conferences where there's a much easier mixing of people that read the books or are just borderline curious with the hardcore people that, you know, do the investigations and write the books and all. And they will come up to you after a talk and say, that was very interesting, and let me tell you what I know. And they will lay out this amazing pantheon of information that there are 157 different races visiting the Earth, and Pleiadians come in this kind of ships, and they eat bugs and dust, and then there are the Nordics, and they do this, and they're here for this reason. And they lay it all out, and you nod, and you listen as respectfully as you can, and then, in conversation, say, can I ask you, with all due respect, how do you know this? And there are only several responses. One is, that's what they told me. and there's nowhere really to go from there. Well, I read this book, or I spoke to this person, or that is what my channel instructed me, or I had this dream. And for some people, these things are research. These things are evidence. These things are proof, where for others of us, they're interesting, they're anecdotal, and taken in tandem with other information that maybe you can get your hands around. It does lead to shifting your own thinking, and we all should be open to that. But sometimes folks either don't make a very good case or their case is extremely weak. There's a lot of backbiting, and I think you're going to find that in any field of study, God knows, in politics, and
yeah.
There is a lot of politics in this.
And it is true that once you get into this field, you start to feel, I think probably everyone passes through a phase where you feel like, you know, who am I to say that this thing I just heard of isn't true?
Mm-hmm. Fair enough.
Lord knows, a year ago I heard about some other things and I thought that can't possibly be true, and since then I've seen evidence and I've talked to people, and you know what? I had to come around to accept it.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you see new things and you think, well, it sounds outrageous, but so did that other thing I looked at last year and I was wrong about that.
Right, exactly.
I can give you a perfect example. Some years into my own investigations, it was suggested to me in so many words by a number of different people, completely separately, that some of these other intelligences may actually look just like us, and some of them may pass as human beings. Well, I didn't like that one at all. That made me extremely anxious. The implications being that that person next to me on the subway, or this person...
Exactly.
That direction lies madness.
Doesn't it seem utterly logical? I mean, really, when you think
about it. Yeah, and I'm still not crazy about it, but it's no more wild than a thing that looks like,
right.
You know, an interdimensional octopus.
Let's say there is some interdimensional octopus, and they're interested in us, but they also realize that they really want to... What if they want to influence us? What if they're interested in us in that way? They should be. They should be after what we've done in the last 50 years of our own history. We're not just sitting around with horses pulling carts anymore. Okay, we're doing some serious stuff. And so if there are other beings looking at us, you got to think that they find us very, very interesting. And maybe even getting a little nervous, frankly. Okay? For real. And so what would they want to do? They would want to find a way maybe to infiltrate, influence. I mean, that sounds crazy, but it's very logical. If I were an alien, this would be what I'd want to do.
Yeah, but you have this control thing, Rich.
I do. Well, maybe they do, too.
Not it's just
so what you
terms.
Do.
You were talking about a World War II resistance story where we have trained an operative to speak German flawlessly and dress in the right clothes, and they've got all the perfectly fake credentials.
You take a genetically...
Behind the line, Holland.
Modify them.
It's functionally identical.
Them, enhance them in one way or another, and there you go.
Yep.
Okay, here's a question for you gentlemen. Mm. Based on sort of on the kind of research that I had been speaking about, you know, I've been talking about alien images and aliens and UFOs being presented in TV shows and movies.
Mm.
And why might we be doing this? Are we trying to mold public perception about these things?
Mm.
Now, Peter, Rich, and I and our kids have been watching the show Heroes.
Oh, yes, I haven't, but I know people that do that rave about it. I guess I should.
Well, it's
amazing.
Me in. It's incredibly well filmed. It's well written. It's wonderful. It's a fantastic, fascinating
Abrams, great.
Thing to watch. But it's all about these people who look just like us. In fact, they start out human, but they've been genetically modified, and they have what they call abilities, what we used to call superpowers in the comic
right.
books.
Right, exactly. And I know some of them are very cute.
Well, yeah.
It's TV. It's a TV show.
Apparently, being a supermodel is like one of the abilities that they also have.
It's a good world to live in.
Walk down a rut like nobody's business.
So, but my point is, now here's a show that's wildly popular.
Yeah.
And it's all about people who look just like us, but they have abilities that we don't.
Yeah.
Like
right.
one is able to read minds, and he's not only able to read what's in your mind, he's able to put things in your mind and make you perceive things any way he wants you to.
That's right.
I think that is one of the great places where fiction assists us in adjusting to grand changes in thinking or possibilities. for fans of that show who are following it now, let's say 7 years from now, there's some major announcement through the Department of Defense that we can do this, that we have been doing this, they will probably be less rattled than people like me that haven't been watching the show.
Right. Now, can't you just see Obama coming out and saying, well, you know, there's all these people who they're all in our society, and I know this is hard to follow, but you guys watch Heroes? Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, it's like that.
Yeah, just like that. Yeah.
Exactly. And that may well be that simple. No, you're right. I remember that during the Republican convention in New York in 2004, which I thought took a lot of nerve, something came up in the news, and it was a news story in the Times and other major venues for a day or two, and then it disappeared for good and ever. And I was amazed, because it was one of those things that seemed like the forces that be would have rather this hadn't happened. The Republicans were so concerned about, you know, 60 Styles riots in the streets by progressive liberal-thinking people, well, not unlike myself, that the Defense Department loaned the New York City Police Department, I understand, a truck-mounted device that looked like a big ray gun and that could be trained on a crowd. And it had a wide-angle function or a narrow-beam function.
Peter,
where
you, 04 wow. convention?
Yeah, this is, yes, and it was for crowd control, and what it specifically was able to do was create a tremendous amount of physical discomfort that would preoccupy you with feeling not well, and you might, you know, throw up or something, and by changing a knob, you could affect hundreds of people on a street or focus it in on one person. Well, this story got into the news, and there was a hue and cry, and overnight, the New York City Police Department said, we are not going to use this. It is being returned to the Defense Department. And that was the end of the story. And
yeah,
that was it.
Of course, that means the Defense Department still uses
well,
it and has it.
Well, and it makes you wonder, if they have that,
right.
How long have they had that? Once again, going back to the idea of our great technological breakthroughs, the result of back engineering of crashed alien craft, or are we human beings, at our best, extraordinary? And could we have created the digital revolution and fiber optics and the internet and personal computers and cell phones and all that stuff by ourselves?
Well, I would suggest that it's a bit of both. Because
I think that may well be. And
right,
once again, if the toys that have filtered down to us include these devices not much bigger than a pack of cigarettes that you connect you up with anybody anywhere in the world at any time, or the other, you know, known wonderful miracles, where are we in terms of the highly classified technology? That is something that never fails to intrigue me.
I have an opinion on this, and I'll just share it. In fact, I put that in the introduction of my new book. I'm theorizing that we are maybe dealing in our society with what I now call a breakaway civilization. I mean, think about how this might be possible. Seriously. Think back to the old Cold War. All right, you got the U.S., you got the Soviet Union, and they were, in many ways, two very separate types of civilizations. Yes, there was interaction between the two, obviously, but there were a lot of differences, and there was a lot of lack of communication. Western science went in certain directions that Soviet science actually did not go in, and ditto with Soviet science. And so we already have an example within our recent history of two different types of scientific infrastructures developing, right? So what happens if, now you look at the black budget, all right, and you have this enormous amount of money, let's, for all practical purposes, almost an infinite amount of money going in secretly to this one part of society that there's no oversight over this group. And let's say they get 50, 60 years, and they get a nice head start with some exotic alien technology that they've acquired. Is it possible that within the so-called black world that they make a breakthrough, and then another breakthrough, and then another breakthrough, because one always leads to another? What if, really, what if they made such a breakthrough, and that this breakthrough allowed them to master things like what we would call flying saucer technology? And what if it allowed them to get a jump start on advanced artificial intelligence?
Yep.
or even being able to manipulate space-time in some way that we don't yet understand. What if? All right, I'm just tossing it out there as a possibility. I think it is possible, actually.
Absolutely.
And if they did it, would they want to share it with the rest of the world? Well, I think they might not.
Yeah.
And so if they do that, then here, now it really gets interesting. Because what if there are these other beings out there, too? So suddenly you have the black world, the secret world, going off on its own, maybe, just maybe, dealing with them in a way that we here on the ground have no clue about.
Yeah.
I just wonder. And so is it a, I would call it a breakaway civilization, because in a lot of ways, yes, this is a group that would still deal with our civilization in many ways, but in other significant ways, it's possible, I'm just saying it's possible, that they are really so radically advanced that we can truly call them a different civilization altogether.
I think that is a mind-expanding thought. And you know what? Once again, if you connect the dots, it simply makes common sense. At the end of the train of thought, we have the interesting philosophical slash real-world problem of, gee, we now have cracked the great time continuum and have the potential rudimentary device that will allow us to traverse time a little bit. How do we even begin to break it to, you know, the so-called regular folks in the world that we can do this? And if we do, how can we even begin to tell them how we got there without revealing certain things that we don't want them to know about the source of the original development? Yeah, it sets up a problem. Reminds me of that great episode of Star Trek where they leave a phaser on the planet of the Chicago gangsters. And, of course,
very
clever, and they take it apart, and within 100 years, they're going to be out in the star systems with their double-breasted suits and
getting a piece of the action.
You got that right. Forget about it.
That was the name of that episode. Piece of the action.
Thank you so much, Gene Roddenberry, for giving us some of the models that we use in our thinking.
I got a lot of useless stuff crowded
out. That was a great one.
It's in there.
Wow.
Yeah, there's a lot to think about with this, and we're in a position where we have certain facts at our disposal, but then the facts take you so far. And then what you're left with, it's like almost doing archaeology.
It is.
You got the bones, right? But you're missing some bones. And so you have to kind of figure out logically, like, what fits here the best. And
so
that's where debate comes in, and that's where not everyone's going to agree, but we have to do our best.
Well, that's the cutting edge of this work, and it's one of the things that reminds me when you sort of pull back and try to take in this period of time, these decades that we have lived through and the decades to come, which is a relatively small slice. This is an extraordinary moment in human evolution, and there will be a time, hundreds, hopefully even a few thousand years in the future, where people look back on the latter part of the 20th century, the early part of the 21st century, and say, my goodness, what an amazing period that was. Almost everyone was playing with their little blackberries and walking around like sleepwalkers, but there were people like Bud Hopkins and James McDonald and Wilhelm Reich and these pioneers who were cracking the code, who were looking to the future, who now, you know, have established areas of study where, of course, it's not a matter of going to study the history of UFOs. It's which UFO university are you going to go to? And, you know, it reminds me in, I guess, the 70s, the very first time a respected American university taught a course in rock music. Well, isn't that the limit? What a silly novelty. And now, of course, people get PhDs in, you know, popular music, and it's considered a perfectly respectable area of study. It's just so interesting being caught up in the middle of it and occasionally remembering what an historic period of time we are living through and in our own small ways contributing to.
Yes, well said, sir. I think that's exactly right. And the pace of history has just increased so dramatically. And again, this is why I am convinced that other intelligences that are observing us and interacting with us are particularly interested in us right now. a lot of times I, you know, we all run into people who say things like, oh, well, we're just so backward and primitive. Why would advanced aliens be interested in us? And the answer is, we're not. I mean, there's a lot of, we all have family members, so we all know what backward can be. Okay, sure. But we also have a lot going on.
Yeah.
And we are at a point where we are just in a state of constant technological revolution.
Mm-hmm. Well, think about it in conventional Best Buy terms. Computer technology, digital camera technology, outdates itself completely about every 18 months. And, you know, things that right now, and look at it just purely in mercantile terms, the great Panasonic digital 10.2 megapixel camera that I have sitting next to me, which was state-of-the-art 2 years ago and cost me $500, I can get those same features in a very nice little camera by Sony or another major company for $160 now. Probably is, you know, got some new features as well. It's fascinating.
Yeah, and like I've been convinced for a while, in about 15 years now from now, your computer will be telling you, it'll be saying, hey, Peter, how are you this morning? And you'll have extended conversations with your computer, and it's going to seem like it's conscious.
Yes.
You might believe it.
Sometimes I wonder about the one that I have.
Right.
I'm very proud to say a signed photograph up here on my wall of Cair Dulay, the wonderful classically trained actor who we all know, even if we're not film maniacs like me, as astronaut Dave Bowman, 2001. Good morning, Dave.
Ah, yes.
And
yes,
that seemed so far-fetched in 1969 or 70 or whenever it came out. And now, it's not that far-fetched at all. And your kids never knew it.
Retro now.
There wasn't an internet or, you know, electronic.
The year of the day my computer wakes up and becomes conscious, because I'm a great one for swearing at my computer when it doesn't work.
Uh-oh, be careful. It may start
to get back at me. Oh, man.
Or
I'm going to be in so much trouble.
Child may, anyway. It'll remember.
No, it will.
You know, you shouldn't have talked to my grandmother like that. Take this.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think you should have your email today, because you weren't nice. So.
Or let me just make a few simple changes in the email.
Yeah.
And see if that screws up your day very nicely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll send that for you in just a second. Let me just edit. There we go.
Well, you know, there are some very leading thinkers in the field of AI who are afraid of exactly that type of a thing. The co-founder of Sun Microsystems, that's a big company, a man by the name of Bill Joy, has for many, many years decried the inevitable development of strong artificial intelligence. He says, you know, they could pull a Terminator on us, and he's not joking. There are other people in the field who do take that seriously. And the problem is, this is like a train that's left the station. There's no way to stop it.
Oh, not anymore.
You can't just tell developers around the world, don't make better code anymore. I mean, they're just going to do it. And so at a certain point, this is an inevitability, whether for better or for worse. There's really no stopping this.
You know, there's another aspect of that, and of course we're off topic now, but who cares, I remember the first time I heard somebody describe...
Peter, I'm losing you. I can't hear you.
Yeah, you're fading out.
Idea of a computer virus. I was talking into my radio for a moment there. And my first question was, you mean somebody invented something to screw up my computer? Yes. Why did they do that? Well, why do people do anything? And that there are people right now, as we speak, sitting at home, on their own, simply to, as an intellectual challenge or because they're pathological people, who are doing nothing but designing new, more sophisticated, destructive computer viruses
right.
to screw up our personal lives and the world at large. You know, there's the human aspect as well as the intelligence of machines that is kind of conspiring for this bad part of Brave New World here.
Yeah, it's like we're on a tightrope that's going higher and higher and higher. So the higher we go, the cooler it is, but there's also a danger of falling really, really far.
Whew.
So it makes for a giddy ride.
Yeah. Well put.
I just make this up as I go. I'm just making it up as I go here, people.
With the last few minutes that we have, anything special that we want to touch on?
Well, what are you doing these days, Peter? I haven't really...
I thought you'd never ask.
I tried to ask.
I'm afraid to ask.
I know. No, this is Rich's show, and I wanted I really wanted the main part of it to be about the book and my reactions to what I've read, and I'm expecting chapter two at some point in the near future. Thank you.
Anytime.
I have been working away on a number of conference papers that I am now forced to produce because I had this silly notion that I wanted to make a living this year, and I am one of those rare crazy people who pretty much does try to make their living in this unusual field rather than have the security of what we call a job. And so after the stock market tanked in mid-September, within a few weeks, I had three conference organizers, one from the Midwest, one from the smaller UFO festival conference in New Mexico in March, and one in England, contact me and say, we are so sorry, but due to what looks like a bad financial stretch, we can no longer keep our agreement with you, and as such, you will not be speaking at our conference. Good luck.
Oh, wow.
Well, yeah, and, you know, I basically said, well, I'm sure this is going to be happening, but what I did was I redoubled my efforts to contact organizers and folks in the field and say, hi, I'm available. These are X number of topics that you can call on me to speak on, and here's a whole bunch of abstracts for papers that I'm just putting out the idea, and if you're interested in hiring me, I will create that paper for your conference. And though I lost the three jobs, I got about six jobs. And it was one of those things where daring yourself to do something and then you've got to do it. So right now I'm working away very hard on my MUFON paper. And even though that isn't until August, you know, they vet the papers carefully and of course they produce a published proceeding. So I have to have that in May 1st. And that's going to be a really challenging paper. In fact, the title of it is Politics, Religion, and Human Nature, Practical Problems and Incendiary Roadblocks on the Path to Disclosure. And I'm not going to make some friends on this one. I think it's going to be one of the most challenging papers I've ever presented, and I'm excited about it, but I'm also a bit anxious, so working away on that one. I've got two papers for a conference in Liverpool in September on Dr. Wilhelm Reich, the first one, and on Reich's work relative to UFOs. Exeter, New Hampshire is going to be having its very first, hopefully annual, UFO conference in September, and I'm going to be doing a paper called The Power of Ridicule Versus a Most Uncomfortable Truth, Why We Need to Take UFOs Seriously. And it's going to be about the origins of the ridicule factor. I've got a small talk coming up in Philadelphia in July, another talk at the Roswell Public Library a few weeks before that in July. Although I'm not speaking at Roswell, I am going to be coordinating the conference and meeting regularly on the phone now with the folks on the mayor's committee, and I'm looking forward to that. And coming up toward the end of the year, I've got two papers that I'll be doing at the Crash Retrieval Conference. One, a reevaluation of the Voronezh UFO incident in 1989 in the Soviet, well, in Russia.
Really?
Yes, I'm finally going to do that.
I read about that from my book.
No, actually, I'm very excited to say that when that story broke, and I mean the day it broke, in autumn of 1989, I was home in my first year of working on Left at Eastgate with the TV on in the background, and the report started to come on TV, and I flipped, and I popped in a tape, and I started taping them, and they were all TASS news releases, and I'm up on West 57th Street, and I thought, the offices of TASS in New York are in Rockefeller Center. Why don't I just take a chance here? I got their number from information, and I called them. And I said, with as professional a voice as I could, I'm intrigued by the story that you've put out today. I am an investigative writer specializing in this subject, and then I let them know I was of Russian ancestry. Didn't mention that I was Jewish. I didn't think that would help. I said, I wonder if I might come by your office and speak with some of your people there. Oh, yes, Mr. Robbins, come on by. And the next thing I knew, I'm sitting in the TASS office in Rockefeller Center and leave there with a handful of original telexes. Soon after, I established contact with an associate professor in Voronezh, who was on one of the first investigative teams. We became good friends. So it's going to be a very personal paper.
I think you have the last word, because am I hearing music in the background?
It may well be. I think we're coming into time, and
no,
of course I'll put...
No, I don't hear music, but we are definitely winding down.
I thought I heard music.
And you may be hearing music in your mind, you know. But yeah, a couple of other papers as well. And, you know, mostly at this point working away in my office, generating material for months now, but realizing if I don't stay on the case now, I'm going to be really over my head come summer. So yeah, I've been a busy bee here, and a whole bunch of conferences coming up. We'll pick up on that next month at our next get-together.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Thanks so much for joining me, you guys. This has been really great. I'm so glad to be able to connect with you again.
Our pleasure, and welcome home again, even belatedly, from your new exalted position in Nevada.
Yeah, thanks.
Yes, you and the Stonecutters.
Thanks to all my listeners who joined in. And if you missed the first half of the show, I know a lot of people joined in halfway through. Definitely download this one and catch the first half. It was really fun. You've been listening to Through the Keyhole live on the Paranormal Radio Network and on UPRN 105.3 FM in New Orleans. I'm your host, Karen Dolan. My guests this evening were Rich Dolan and Peter Robbins, UFO researchers. And we've been doing our regular monthly chat about all of our current projects, current events, and anything that sounds like fun. Thanks for listening, everybody. See you next week.